You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Darrell Conner.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a new project from Wisconsin Life wants to help listeners explore their Wisconsin-related curiosities. We'll hear the first story from that new project.
But right now, incoming Democratic Governor Tony Evers announced the first members joining his cabinet today in Milwaukee and what his goals will be for these appointments.
We're going to ensure that we bring back science to the Department of Natural Resources, that we work across the state to reform our criminal justice system and address racial disparities, as well as improving public safety. We're going to also highlight for all the world to see that Wisconsin has a lot to offer, and that we do it by running an efficient and effective government that's focused on finding solutions and making sure that our state remains a great state to live and work.
The new members of his government are Joel Brennan, Preston Cole, Kevin Carr, and Sarah Meany. All of them have strong ties to the state's largest city.
But their ties to Milwaukee have some state Republican lawmakers crying foul. Some have criticized Evers for being too focused on the city itself and ignoring the rest of the state with his choices.
Our next guest is here to talk about the roles filled so far and what challenges these appointees could face with the state legislature.
Laurel White is the state capitol reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio News. Laurel, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, let's take a look at the four people that will be joining Evers' cabinet. Let's start with Joel Brennan. Who is he?
So Joel Brennan is currently the CEO of Milwaukee's Discovery World Science and Technology Museum, and he is going to lead the Department of Administration under the Evers administration. Another kind of interesting tidbit about Joel Brennan is that he had previously worked in politics running Milwaukee Mayor Tom Barrett's bid for governor in 2002 and mayoral run in 2004. So he's certainly not a stranger to Wisconsin politics.
What exactly does the Secretary of the Department of Administration do?
So the Department of Administration has a little bit of an opaque title, but it's actually a very powerful department within any administration because it oversees the implementation of the state budget. So DOA is going to be very, very integral to the state budget negotiations going forward. They're the ones that post a lot of the documents, the governor's budget proposal, and the various changes. So people can check in with that DOA website to watch all the minutiae of the state budget in the coming months.
Is there any particular changes that Evers wants to bring to this department?
Not that I'm aware of off the top of my head. I think, you know, the primary way that people interact with DOA is through the budget. So we'll see if Governor-elect Evers has any big changes in store for that. Interestingly, in his budget address, which we're expecting in the first couple months of 2019.
Kevin Carr has been appointed as the head of the Department of Corrections. What experience does Carr bring to this role?
So Carr is currently the U.S. Marshal for the Eastern District of Wisconsin. Prior to that, he worked in the Milwaukee County Sheriff's Office. So some background there with law enforcement. He is a Milwaukee resident, as you mentioned before. And he spoke today about how he's interested in kind of building on the changes to criminal justice law that Congress just passed, kind of bringing maybe some of those changes to Wisconsin.
Preston Cole will join the administration as the head of the State Department of Natural Resources. What exactly is his background in forestry?
Cole has been a figure in the DNR universe of Wisconsin for quite a while. It's pretty interesting because he was actually first appointed to the state DNR board by Democratic Governor Jim Doyle. He was reappointed by Governor Walker, which is something that doesn't often happen in state politics, kind of a reappointment across parties. And now he's staying with Governor-elect Evers. And actually, Governor Walker tweeted his support for Evers' choice today. He said Preston Cole is a solid pick. He said he did a good job on the board and understands the importance of it to the entire state. So I think Preston Cole is somebody people are talking about as a bipartisan pick as DNR secretary.
Laurel White is the state capitol reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio News. And we're talking about Wisconsin Governor-elect Tony Evers and some of his choices for his cabinet. One that I know has drawn quite a bit of controversy is Sarah Meany, who was appointed as the head of the state tourism department. What exactly, first of all, is her background?
So Meany is currently the chief marketing officer for Milwaukee Film, which is the city's annual film festival. Before that, she was an advertising executive at an advertising agency.
Well, the reason why I brought up the controversial part is because she's going to be replacing Stephanie Klett, who mm-hmm. was immensely popular around the state of Wisconsin. There were a number of editorials asking Governor-elect Evers to keep her on. There were a number of people that that spoke certainly to keep her on, but she is being replaced. What mm-hmm. does Evers want to accomplish with this department?
So he said today that he wants to help, promote Wisconsin as a tourism destination for people from all over the country and really reinforce that as an economic driver for Wisconsin. We know, of course, that Wisconsin is definitely a tourist destination, some of the parks, the Dells. So I think he really wants to build on that through his administration.
Now, Governor-elect Evers was asked about criticisms today at the announcement. Here's what he said.
We only have four today, and I happen to be in Milwaukee, and these four happen to be from Milwaukee. We will have more announcements in the near future, and I think the criticism will be dissipated as we move forward. Wherever people reside in the state of Wisconsin, in any state agency or any public agency or any private business knows that talent is what drives success, and I'm looking for talent, and these four people have it in a very, very high level.
Are there any other rumored appointees from other parts of the state that you know of?
Not that I know of. I do know that Governor-elect Evers has alluded to making appointments of people from other parts of the state because, you know, as we heard there, he says, I think that future appointments are going to silence some of those criticisms of these four individuals coming from Milwaukee. He did say today that he's expecting to make a lot of those appointments, hopefully before the holiday, so we could get some answers to that. And just as far as kind of the specific geographical makeup of his administration within the next few days, really.
To be continued. Thank
exactly.
you so much, Laurel, for joining us.
Sure thing. Thank you.
Laurel White is the state capitol reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio News. She joined us today to talk about Democratic Governor-elect Tony Evers' appointments to his cabinet today.
Coming up, we'll hear about a brand new project from WPR that gives you the power to shape more of our content. We want to know what you're interested in hearing more stories about. Find out how here on Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Darrell Connor.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, what would you say are the most important things to happen in Milwaukee over the past 20 years? We'll hear what historian John Gerda has to say when we discuss his newly updated book on the history of the city.
Right now, it's time for something special and brand new. This is a new project that allows you, our listeners, to shape the stories you hear on air. Let's take a listen to the first story of Wisconsin.
Many of us were obsessed with certain PBS shows as kids. Zoom, 3-2-1 Contact, Reading Rainbow. I could keep going, but today, let's talk about one particular show, Story Lords. I did not grow up with Story Lords. I hadn't even heard of it until my in-law, Nick Drozdowicz, told me about rediscovering the show at a bar in Seattle.
And right as things were starting to clear out, for some reason, I just remembered this show I used to watch as a kid on Wisconsin Public Television, which happened to be Story Lords. And I thought, man, I wonder if that show is as weird as I remember it being.
Nick and the bartender pulled up the show on YouTube and watched all 12 episodes that night.
And it was like 115% as strange as I remember it being.
I mentioned this story to two coworkers. Tara Shillard and Lydia Roussos freaked out over the memory of Story Lords. But they calmed down once I interviewed them.
I wanted a glitter glove.
Yep, the glitter gloves were like a big deal. And I remember the bike trainer specifically.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Lydia, Tara, and Nick are like many Wisconsin students who grew up watching Story Lords in the 80s and 90s.
Thunder and lightning, trumpets and drums. Readers rejoice, the Story Lord comes.
The sci-fi adventure was created for students in second, third, and fourth grades to reinforce reading lessons.
When this ring glows, sit on yon bikatron and pedal as fast as you can.
Story Lords aired in classrooms and on PBS stations across the country. It's about siblings Norbert and Mandy. They have to save another planet by solving reading puzzles.
Dandelions!
If they don't, the evil Thorzul will turn everyone into stone.
What do you think, Milk Breath? Wouldn't he make a cute little stone doorstop?
Spoiler alert, Norbert and Mandy foil him every time.
When I was a kid, I found it to be kind of edgy. There was something that seemed like a little dark, like people watch SVU or like the X-Files now. And that, I guess, Story Lords was my version of that when I was like 8.
Nearly 25 years after watching the show, Nick, Tara, and Lydia all had lingering questions about Story Lords.
How did this show get made? Show me the sausage.
To get to the bottom of this, I hopped on my own magical exercise bike and transported to the mystical land of Menominee, Wisconsin. That's where Story Lords was made in the mid-1980s. And that's where I talked with Ed Jacober, the show's producer and director. He says a committee of researchers shaped the show's educational strategy. Ed filmed the show around town.
Thorzul's lair. Okay, let's go to the inside of Mabel Tainter.
All our extras we get from the theater department. The kids were just the kids.
Superfan Lydia had another question for the bad guy Thorzul. They wanted to know.
I just want to know how he got involved. Did he have, like, associations with UW Stout at the time?
The first time I heard of it, Dave Conyer called me and he said, Larry, have you still got your chin whiskers? And I said, well, yeah, why? He said, well, we're doing this reading program and there's a bad guy in it and we think he needs your chin whiskers. And I said, well, my chin whiskers, I come along with them. And so I came down and looked at the first script.
That's Larry Laird, a.k.a. Thorzul. Larry went to UW Stout, where he discovered his love of acting. He was involved in the community theater when Story Lords executive producer asked him to try out for the show.
Being dyslexic, I'm willing to do just about anything I can do to help kids read. I looked at that and I was just fell in love with it immediately.
Tanya Tiffany landed the role of the hero Mandy after taking drama classes in her hometown of Eau Claire.
I think I got the part because I was older than the age of the characters. So I could read and I could do all of the things, but I was also really tiny.
Tanya says she loved working on the show with Ed and Larry.
But yeah, no, I remember sort of long days, and like running to the shed and putting on the gloves and getting on the magic exercise bike, which takes you to the magic reading land.
Lydia had one more question for their favorite character. This is where I should probably mention that Lydia dressed as Thorzul for Halloween in high school.
Do people recognize him out and about? People are like, oh my God, excuse me, sir, you Thorzul?
Yes. Probably one of the quickest ways to elicit that response was if I laugh at something.
As for Tanya, she says no one recognized her for playing Mandy.
But once people realize that I'm the kid from Story Lords, they never have a hard time. No one ever says, oh gosh, you don't look like that at all anymore. It's always sort of, oh yeah, that's absolutely you, with hopefully slightly better clothes and a slightly less bad haircut.
While Tanya was not thrilled with Mandy's wardrobe, other costumes from Story Lords stick out. Here's superfan Tara asking about Thorzul's costume.
I would want to know how his costume came about. He had like this box shape gown and he was on a motorcycle.
Yeah, it was like hip hop Darth Vader.
Yes. Yeah.
Well, I suspect it was Star Wars, right? I mean, the Darth Vader.
Yeah, I think so. There's a little bit of that. I know my wife did some of them. Yeah.
It's black material and it's three layers of cardboard. I still have it. It's still wearable.
Superfan Nick had a question for the cast and crew.
What do you think those guys are doing, like, right now?
Here's director Ed Jacober.
Where am I now? Oh, I'm still working at Stout. Now I do instructional program here and administer the video streaming service here, too.
And Larry Laird?
I'm retired from whatever it is I've done. I've been probably self-employed most of my life. Lucky enough to do some traveling and get grandkids.
As for Tanya Tiffany.
So I teach art history at UW-Milwaukee, and my specialization is 17th century Spain.
And since all the superfans got to ask questions, I had one of my own. What is the legacy of Story Lords?
I think it's just unusual and surprising, and I'm very pleased it's still around and people are even aware of it. Mm-hmm. Lots of people love it. And I don't understand.
Yeah. And if I think about it too much, I'll choke up right here. Because you never know when you throw that pebble into the pond where the ripples are going to go. And that was one of them that I was intensely proud of being involved in this. Reading has always been a blessing to me and a place that I can go to. And so I want that for everybody.
I think a lot of the lasting legacy is due to nostalgia that we all have for our childhoods.
It draws back to the fun things that you remember from school.
This big TV would be wheeled in and plugged in. It must have been sort of an event in a way that I'm sure it's not anymore. Presumably there's so much programming now, right, that there won't be one show that all of the kids of a certain age end up watching.
This story was put together for a new project through Wisconsin Life. It's called Why Sconson? Just like Tara, Lydia, and Nick in this story, you ask the questions, we find the answers. Find more about this project and send us your questions at WPR.org/Wisconsin. That's W-H-Y, Sconson. Get it? Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lola Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Maureen McCollum joins us in studio to tell us more about the project. Maureen is the host and producer of Wisconsin Life, which is creating the Wisconsin stories. Maureen, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Where did the concept for Wisconsin come from?
So I had heard about Wisconsin through another of other public radio stations. It started out as Curious City at WBEZ in Chicago. And essentially the concept is bringing the public into the stories we're creating more, right? So someone asks a question, and then the reporters or talk show producers go out and answer that question. So it's just a different way that we can engage with the audience that we have.
Now, you're looking for questions from listeners,
sure.
And I guess you already have some that you brought with you. You jotted them down. What kind of questions have we heard so far that might be in the hopper for future segments for Wisconsin Life or for us?
Yeah, sure. So I should say, first and foremost, like, you know, we hope and love that people are sending their questions in, but obviously we can't answer all of them.
No promises here.
No promises. But the ones we can answer will range from like completely strange and bizarre like Story Lords and even to things more serious like maybe climate change in Wisconsin. So some of those questions that we've already gotten so far, we've gotten a few food-related stories.
Yeah.
A couple people have asked us, what's the deal with Friday Fish Fry in Wisconsin? Mm-hmm. Other questions, a couple questions come in about why are cannibal sandwiches popular in Wisconsin, which is apparently a raw meat sandwich.
Right. Wow. Yeah.
I had not heard of them before.
Why, Lord, why, I think is the way one would express that.
Yeah, right.
But some people love them. No offense if you like them.
Yeah. And then, you know, we've heard, like, what's the deal with the Driftless region? Who writes those highway billboard signs that change with the holidays? So, I mean, really, the question could be about anything, and that's the beauty about this project.
Why did you start with Story Lords?
So I started with Story Lords because it seemed like a pretty easy way to start. I did not grow up with Story Lords. I'd never heard of it. And when I first did, you'll hear my in-law, Nick, you know, he was just talking about it. And so he was so excited and he was so engaged in the way he talked about this show. And I started bringing it up to different people I knew that were, you know, kind of like late 20s to early 40s, people who would have watched this in school. And their faces would just light up every time they talked about Story Lords. And like, oh my gosh, I can't remember that show. So as I did a bunch of research, I realized it was made in Wisconsin. And there was like no information out there on this show. So I figured this would be a good place to start, fill in the blanks.
Now, I'm excited about Why Sconson, and I'll tell you why. We try to I'll say borrow politely. I said rip off the Curious City
yeah.
idea from Chicago when we started Central Time.
Yeah.
And we wanted, but we didn't have that one landing site. So we're like, email us your question or call or whatever, social media us. So I'm hoping there's this one site, and I'm hoping this gives you ideas and us ideas. Talk again a little more about how people can get involved in this.
Yes. So you go to WPR.org/Wisconsin. That's W-H-Y. Wisconsin. And through that, you'll be able to just submit your question through the box. So the question will be, what do you wonder about Wisconsin, its people, and its culture that you'd like Wisconsin to look into? And it's really easy to use. You'll just enter your name. You'll enter your email so we can get back in touch with you if you do have a question. And then we're going to ask for your zip code. And the reason we're asking for the zip code is so we can see, like, oh, maybe there aren't any questions coming in from Ashland County. We'll reach out to folks in Ashland County and say, hey, what are some stories you have? Because we really want to diversify, like, geographically also where these stories are coming from.
Can you give some of our listeners, speaking of stories, mm-hmm. some ideas of what they may submit, you know, stories about?
Yeah. So, you know, if you're someone who's really interested in, let's say, like, nature in Wisconsin, okay. why is it that the road that I lived on is just filled with oak trees? You know, there's going to be a history there. Why is it that that city decided to plant a row of oak trees back in the 1900s? Maybe people want to know, like, what does the word Wisconsin come from? And so we can dig into the history of the word Wisconsin.
So this is just whatever people, like, you're driving around, walking around, whatever, whatever curious thing. And it might be something zany. And you're saying it might be something really serious.
Totally. Yeah. I think the one thing we're going to try to avoid are questions that sort of have a political bend to them. We've gotten a few submissions like that.
What's wrong with my political opponents? What's the deal with them?
Exactly. Yeah. And we're going to try to stay clear of that.
So no exposés?
What's that?
No exposés about
Yeah, right. Well, you never know. I mean, but at the same time, seeing how this project evolves, there could be some deep investigative stories that come out of questions that people ask. Sure.
And the philosophy here is, and I love this, that to put it one way, our listeners get to shape what we do.
Yes.
And then on the other hand, we get to be lazy because the ideas are just coming into us and we don't have to think as much.
Well, I mean, it's impossible for one reporter or one producer to know everything that's going on in the state. So I think this makes it a really easy way for us to connect to the listeners and connect to people who have questions.
And do you have another installment coming out soon before we let you go?
Yes. Aha. So the next one will be coming up. I have to narrow it down to like three different stories. So I'm sorry, I don't have my official answer yet, but the next story will be rolling out mid-January.
How can they get in touch with you to submit ideas?
So if you go to WPR.org/Wisconsin, go there. All the information will be there. We also have created a Twitter account. It's Wisconsin, WHYSconsin. So you can follow all the stories that we'll be rolling out through the project that way.
Maureen, thanks so much for joining us in studio. That was Maureen McCollum, producer of Wisconsin Life. She joined us to talk about a new project called Wisconsin. You can visit WPR.org/Wisconsin to submit your question about our state and take a look at the story so far.
Coming up, the 1999 book, The Making of Milwaukee, is the real history of the city, and it's just been updated to reflect the last 20 years. We'll talk to the author coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Darrell Connor. Coming up tomorrow at 6 on The Morning Show, a lot of people have fought to get Americans to use the English language in just the right way. But Kate Archer Kent's guest says it's a losing battle because language is untamable. Meet the author of Talk on the Wild Side tomorrow morning at 6 here on the Ideas Network.
First, when the book The Making of Milwaukee came out in 1999, it was the first general history of the city to be written in more than 50 years.
It's considered by many to be the standard history of Milwaukee, chronicling its founding in 1846, the arrivals of several different ethnic groups, socialist mayors in the 1900s, and other pivotal moments.
But a lot of stuff has happened in the 20 years since the book was written, and those developments have been recorded in a newly updated edition of The Making of Milwaukee. John Gerda is a Milwaukee historian and author of The Making of Milwaukee. He also writes for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel's Crossroads section on the first Sunday of the month. John, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Glad to be here, Rob.
Well, it's one thing to look back 100 years and pick out what's important in the history of, say, a city like Milwaukee. Was it more of a challenge to look at the history that's kind of still going on right now?
Oh, definitely. It's a moving target, and it's right in your face. You know, it's like people say their arms are too short so they can't read fine print. Things are just too close, so it's very hard to keep things in focus. At the same time, you know, I felt I had a responsibility to kind of bring this thing up to date into the second decade of the 21st century and at least, you know, make an informed judgment of what the major themes have been since 2000.
Well, reading your chapter, a lot has happened in the last 20 years, some big changes, some continuing trends. Let's talk about just how some of the look of Milwaukee has changed in terms of the buildings and landmarks. There's been a lot.
There's been a huge amount, and one surprise for me was that since 2005, the dollars spent on construction projects in downtown has been $5 billion, and that's not planned or projected. That is in the ground or on the way, And that is unprecedented. There has never been that much money spent. And the result is pretty much a transformation of the downtown area. The skyline is growing. And at the same time, the adjacent neighborhoods around the downtown area, the Menominee Valley. Maybe 3 years ago, I was taking a high school reunion class of 1955 around town. Some of those folks had not been to Milwaukee in 40 years. It took them in the valley. They did not know where they were. It had been transformed that much. So clean industry, bike paths, bioretention ponds, Three Bridges Park. So there have been just a revolutionary change there besides Pottawatomie Casino and the Harley-Davidson Museum. So, yes, the physical look of the central area especially has really changed.
Talk about that Menominee Valley story. I've done a segment on Central Time at one point, and I think for somebody outside the city, we are not necessarily grasping how huge a change has happened there.
It's a huge area in downtown or the central Milwaukee. It's about a half mile wide, 3 miles long. And to a generation of Milwaukeeans who grew up before, we'll say the last 10 years or so, the earmarks were pretty much the smells of the Menominee Valley rendering plants, Red Star yeast, you know, that very organic cloud that would kind of descend over the freeway on overcast days. They are gone, and it had been kind of an eyesore, and it's become an asset. So it was at one time probably the largest single employer in the entire state of Wisconsin, tens of thousands of manufacturing jobs there. And as the economy deindustrialized, you know, those jobs went away, and now it's been transformed to some clean industry, but also recreation and passive green space. The most amazing change down there for me, the Urban Ecology Center, which is a national pioneer in environmental education for kids, put their third center on the south rim of that valley. They're using the Menominee River, which had once been among the most polluted streams of the entire state, for outdoor education. They are doing actually water studies down there. So water quality has preceded all these changes, but it has been just a dynamic revolution.
And you mentioned the economic changes in Milwaukee. Milwaukee famous as an industrial city, as a brewing city. What has changed in the economy in the 20 years?
An awful lot. Deindustrialization was a trend beginning in the early 1980s. That has continued, in some ways accelerated. And kind of the marker in the years since 2000 was the closing of the former A.O. Smith complex, closed as Tower Automotive in 2006. At one time, 9,000 jobs in that plant that was the biggest producer of steel auto frames and truck frames in the entire world. Those jobs are gone. Now it's a business park called Century City that is kind of struggling to find its feet. And a lot of those jobs were held by African Americans, so that has had a catastrophic impact on especially parts of the inner city.
Talking to John Gerda, author of The Making of Milwaukee and the newly updated version of The Making of Milwaukee, looking at the history of the city, especially what's happened in the last couple of decades. And John, one story that hasn't necessarily changed concerns about segregation, racial inequality, poverty in African-American neighborhoods in Milwaukee. What are you looking at over the last 20 years?
I think an awful lot of the same, and in some cases worse, and I don't want to overdo the tale of two cities kind of imagery, but Milwaukee, like most of its peers in the urban north, has been pretty much frozen in place. And what happened is you have all those industrial jobs go away, and you have at one time, I think 1970, more than half of African-American males had production jobs. Now it's about 14%. You know, so it's been just a catastrophic loss. And those jobs were two cars for the family and sending a kid to college, owning a home. And nothing has replaced those jobs on the entry level. So the way I put it was the inner city's economy was first flattened and then frozen. So you have a lack of economic mobility, and that leads directly to a lack of geographic mobility. So segregation really is kind of the result of a pattern where people cannot afford to move to what would be generally considered better areas, better conditions. So there has been certainly kind of a status quo that you don't want to have happen. And it certainly is not just Milwaukee. Chicago, Cleveland, Cincinnati, Philadelphia, Detroit, pretty much the same pattern. It's an issue, a problem that America has not yet gotten its arms around.
when people look back at American history of our time, I think they'll look at the Great Recession and the effects it had. And you write that Milwaukee really felt the Great Recession a lot. Can you talk about how certainly, that played out?
Sure. One of the big impacts certainly was a loss of jobs. I think Milwaukee lost 5% of its jobs in just 2008. A lot of those were manufacturing. But perhaps the most visible impact was the foreclosure crisis that was a trigger, a catalyst for that whole free fall of the economy. And you had, in the run-up, you have the housing bubble that had a lot of predatory lenders going around the inner city especially and selling the dream of home ownership with no underwriting, no money down, no proof of employment. So it really was kind of a disaster waiting to happen, and it did. When that bubble burst, foreclosure crisis claimed roughly 4% of Milwaukee's housing units, which is it's a lot of houses. And most of those, the greater number of those, were in the inner city. And it took a long time for that to kind of work through, and we're still working through it. So you have foreclosures, and what that leads to is board-ups, and what that leads to is teardowns. You know, so as I described it, there is lack of open space is not a problem in large sections of Milwaukee Central City. It's one neighborhood called Lindsay Heights, and this is cumulative, goes back to freeway clearance, urban renewal. In 1950, the population was something like 37,000. Now it's about 8,000. You know, so it's the term I used was Detroitization, and that's going on in large sections of Milwaukee Central City and elsewhere in the urban north.
Now, part of the story you follow in the original version of the book is the changing ethnic makeup over the decades, almost a couple of centuries in Milwaukee. How has that story continued over the last two decades?
It's the same pattern. Milwaukee has always been a city of newcomers. Back in 1890, 86% of the population was immigrants and their kids. That was the highest proportion in the entire country. Today, it's still a city of newcomers, but it is a majority-minority city. Roughly 40% is African American, roughly 17% is Latino, and that's been a real change. The growth of Latino population, Mexican, Puerto Rican, and Southern and Central as well, gone from roughly 6% of the city's population in 1990 to about 17% in 2010. So that's been a major change. And in my old neighborhood on the south side, the old Polish south side, there are now certainly as many signs in Spanish as there were in English when I was growing up. So it's been just a dramatic change. But the important thing, I think, to point out there as well is it's also continuity, that we are still a city of newcomers, and now we've got sort of an updated edition of that with refugees from Myanmar, Somalia, Sub-Saharan Africa. So the story's always repeating itself.
We're talking about the history of Milwaukee with John Gerda. He's the author of The Making of Milwaukee. He recently updated the book to follow the events of the last 20 years or so.
You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. What do you think were the most influential moments in Wisconsin history this millennium? Who do you think played a significant role in making the city what it is? Is there anything going on in Milwaukee today that you think would make future history books? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas at WPR.org.
We'll pick the conversation up coming up on Central Time.
We're talking about the people and events that made Milwaukee the city that it is today with John Gerda. He is a historian and author of The Making of Milwaukee, which was recently updated to cover the past 20 years.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234. What or who do you think has shaped Milwaukee's character, especially in recent years? How would you describe Milwaukee's identity today? And what questions do you have about the city's history, recent or in the more distant past? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas at WPR.org. Well, John, this wasn't in your new book, but Laverne and Shirley, for a lot of people outside of Wisconsin, might have shaped their impression of what Milwaukee was. Of course, actress and director Penny Marshall passed away just yesterday. She was Laverne in the show. Can you talk about how Laverne and Shirley maybe shaped the pop culture view of Milwaukee?
I think it was more an external view than internal. Mm-hmm. If you watched the opening scenes of Laverne and Shirley, there's nothing except City Hall that is identifiable as Milwaukee. That was shot in New York, pretty much. And she talks like a New Yorker. And if you recall the shows, Milwaukee was actually played a relatively minor role in those shows. Obviously, it was about the characters. But it did, in a lot of ways, cement Milwaukee's identity as a producer of beer and kind of a working-class blue-collar town. And I think it was certainly a wholesome image, but I guess you'd describe it as incomplete. I mean, there was more going on even then, and certainly there's been a lot more change since then.
Let's bring on a caller now. David is with us in Mauston. David, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking the call, and thanks for having the author. He's very enjoyable to hear on the radio, on the television, and in print. My comment is the most spectacular recent immigrant to Milwaukee is the basketball star for the Bucks, known by me only as the first name Giannis. I can't pronounce his last name.
Antetokounmpo.
There you go. From Greece. And I'm wondering, he's spoken very highly of Milwaukee. He says he wants to stay here forever. We've heard that before, but hopefully this time it's true. I'm just curious if the author, if you have some insight or perspective on how a successful immigrant like this basketball star Giannis is could highlight others who have been successful, or how he could be, you know, how he's lent his name to highlighting immigrant success in Milwaukee.
David, thanks. A new star and a new arena to play in, too.
Right. People are so different. You think about an earlier star, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. His only cities, the only ones he knew, have been New York and Los Angeles, and he felt culture shock. He described himself as a city man among farmers when he came here.
In Milwaukee.
In Milwaukee. So you get a big city person who has a hard time adjusting. I mean, Giannis, who came up hard, you know, in Greece, and certainly a struggle in his own background, refugees from Africa. He has, I think, found in Milwaukee kind of family values, a slower pace. No, these things are probably attractive to someone who has a less urban or less American urban background than Giannis. I was talking to a Greek friend just last week, and he said that he was in Greece last month, and he said, every kid in Athens, and he said, I don't mean some kids, I mean every kid in Athens has a jersey with number 34 in it. Giannis has become our international ambassador and certainly our most broadly exposed resident in the entire world.
David, thanks so much for bringing that up. We'll go now to Kim in Milwaukee. Kim, hi.
Hi. I haven't read the book yet, but I plan to. But I have a question specific to, I'm actually interested in some information about the Cambridge Woods neighborhood in Milwaukee. And if you can just give a little bit of a history about that particular neighborhood set right, you know, next to the Milwaukee River.
Sure. Shorthand, Cambridge Woods is the area between the Milwaukee River and roughly Oakland Avenue. It's just west of the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee campus. And the pattern there is that on the east side of Milwaukee, the lakeside was also always wealthy, and the riverside was also always working class. So that's the dichotomy, or that's the difference in Milwaukee's east side. And by the time you get up to Cambridge Woods, no, you're almost in Shorewood. The Edgewood Avenue is the line there. You're in an area that is no longer so working class, it's more middle class, but that's the pattern. No, it's much more modest. I think you look at the lot sizes, Cambridge Woods, the average is 30. You get over toward Lake Drive, it's 60. No, so there's a real shift in terms of the economic geography of that entire area. The real amenity there clearly is the Oak Leaf Trail and the Milwaukee River. There's great trails down there, both mountain biking and more formalized hiking. And as that river has come back to life, that's become a really important amenity. And as part of that Milwaukee River Greenway, that's another change, Rob. We're talking about the physical transformations. The Milwaukee River Greenway is the area north of North Avenue up to about Capitol Drive. It's 9 miles of riverfront and about 600 acres of green space. You know, so it's an urban wilderness within about a mile and a half of downtown. And I don't think any other city in the country has that. So it really is a special resource, and it is Cambridge Woods' essentially backyard.
Kim, thanks so much for calling in. We're talking to John Gerda, Milwaukee historian, author of The Making of Milwaukee. A new updated version of the book is out. John, you also get into the politics at the city and county level. One story I want to focus in on, a scandal at the county level leads to an attempted recall, resignation of a county executive, his replacement ultimately by a young conservative Republican lawmaker named Scott Walker.
Yep, that's the start of the Walker phenomenon. You have Tom Amos, who was kind of the old reliable, a courthouse insider. He was Milwaukee's county executive going back to 1992. And then they have this, and it was a scandalous pension plan, and I think it was not well understood even by the people who passed it. I know people on the county board who said they weren't sure what was in it. So they passed it, and as the stock market declined, it just left taxpayers on the hook for millions of dollars. So public outrage boiled over. Seven supervisors were recalled. Tom Amos was forced to step down. And you have this young legislator named Scott Walker from Wauwatosa who walks into what had been a safely Democratic seat on the White Horse of Reform. And in 2002, he becomes Milwaukee's new county executive, stays there for 8 years, and moves on to the Capitol in Madison. So that was the beginning of the career of a guy who became a national figure.
John, we've focused on the more recent history of Milwaukee. I want to spend a little time on the origins, the early days. Milwaukee was originally, what, three villages, and they didn't always play well together?
Yeah, that would not have been on the report card. Plays well with others. You've got Juneau on the east side, Solomon Juneau, Byron Kilburn on the west side, and George Walker on the south side. Walker had a number of problems, among them a temperamental lack of initiative, so he became kind of a distant third. Byron Kilbourne was genuinely nasty in terms of development. Juno was the guy, if you could have a beer with someone, George would have been a good choice. George would have been a good choice, but Solomon Juno as well would have been just a nice guy to hang around with. So you have this great bridge war in 1845 when they're actually trading blows over the issue of bridges. And to this day, the downtown bridges cross the Milwaukee River at an angle because the east and west sides laid out their street systems independently with no intention of conforming.
Yeah, they were.
Antique goes back.
Right. I mean, is there still that like cross river rivalry, or is this kind of, has that faded into the past?
That's faded. It was probably active into the 1930s when there was still debate about who would get the courthouse, you know, who would get the convention center. And what happened was kind of a very informal division of responsibilities where the east side got the finance, the banks, savings and loans, stock brokerages, law firms. The west side got mass retail and entertainment. And to this day, you've got the Pabst Theater on the east side, which is the old German theater, but you've got the Fiserv Forum, the new Bucks Arena there. And a whole lot happening on West Wisconsin Avenue. So in a lot of ways, those patterns have remained. And there's East Town, West Town. The commercial areas are different and perhaps compete on some level, but it's all one downtown, and that's been true for decades.
In our last few moments, John, we might have a snapshot of what a city is, a city like Milwaukee today. Taking the long view, there's always change. What it is today might be something really different in 10, 20 years.
Guaranteed, absolutely guaranteed. Cities are always in the process of reinventing themselves. That's one of the things that makes them unique and I think very appealing. Big changes in the near future include kind of this runaway regionalization. We are becoming one megalopolis from South Bend, Indiana to Madison, and Milwaukee will become one node in that huge conurbation, as they call it. That'll be a big change. Another one that may be beyond the horizon for those of us alive today, but as climate change inundates the coasts, as the ice caps melt and the coastal cities get underwater, as drought dries out the west, where are people going to move? They're going to move to the heartland. The Great Lakes have water, the soil is good, no hurricanes, no earthquakes. So there are scenarios some people are kind of contemplating where Chicago becomes the biggest city in the country and Milwaukee becomes part of that major economic and social heartland. So, yes, there will be change.
Two topics for future shows. John, thanks a lot for joining us.
My pleasure.
John Gerda is a Milwaukee historian. We talked to him about his newly updated version of his book, The Making of Milwaukee.